Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our community, as Dr. Page and Goldstein specialize in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. And now, Your Health.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein, and I'd like to welcome back our great guest co-host, Dr. Bob Gwyther. Welcome back, Bob.
Thanks, Adam. It's great to be here.
You know, it's great to have you. And it's really great that we're going to have an amazing guest today, Dr. Arthur Kaplan, Director of the Division of Medical Ethics at New York University's Langone Medical Center, talking about the ethics of compassionate use, how we make drugs available for those who can't afford it. I'm sure this is something you've had to deal with at different times in your career.
Somewhat. And he really covers the ethical spectrum beyond the drugs. It's the implants and the organs and some of the mechanical devices that he's involved with. So he's quite an experienced fellow.
Well, I'm really looking forward to that conversation. But first, we have some research that matters, Bob. We're going to be able to talk about, does it matter what time you put your preschooler to bed? And in your case, Bob, if you happen to have a grandchild, would that matter?
We're going to talk about communications breakdowns, mismatches between expectations of patients based on what their doctors are saying about their cancer.
We're going to talk about artificial sweeteners and appetite. Well, Bob and I will probably come clean about whether or not we use artificial sweeteners. And what else? What's the last one?
Article talking about the patient's self-rated health, and does that matter to doctors?
Yeah, well, we'll find out. Let's dive right into that very first research that matters about preschool bedtimes. Can it be related to obesity later in life? We know obesity is such a huge problem, not only for adults, but for young adults, teenagers, and young children. What do you think?
I think after reading this article, I have to pay a little bit more attention to that, because this, done at The Ohio State University College of Public Health, and to be reported in Pediatrics, shows a dramatic effect of kids. They started cohorts at 4.5 years of age and followed them for a long time, and have reports of how they're doing 15, 20 years later. And what they figured out is that kids who make it to bed by 8 o'clock p.m. have far less obesity than those who go to bed between 8 and 9 at the age of 4.5, and those later than 9.
Yeah, you're right. 10% of those who had their earliest bedtimes ended up being obese teens, compared to 16% that went to bed between 8 and 9, and then 23% of those who went to bed latest. And this shows even striking disparities, so that those who tended to go to bed later were non-white, they lived with mothers with less education and lower income, all kinds of factors that could play into this. But it suggests, boy, I would certainly try to have an earlier and more regular bedtime routine for my young toddler.
And for my young grandchildren.
And no ifs, ands, or buts on that one. Let's talk about our next research that matters. And it's about communication between doctors and, in this case, oncologists. And this is research that was published in the Journal of the American Medical Association subspecialty journal, Oncology.
What it attempts to do is take people who have advanced cancer, not, you know, stage one, no symptoms, but people who have to deal daily with it. And they are saying to them, we want you to fill out this questionnaire and tell us how much your doctor thinks, how long you're going to live, and what your quality of life is. And the physicians also filled out the questions, particularly about longevity. What's the prognosis for a long life? And what they found out is that these patients had a very exaggerated opinion about how long they thought they would live based on their doctor's reactions. And they misinterpreted the doctor's actual eventual prognosis.
Right. The doctors, like, had kind of a realistic and, you know, one wouldn't say depressing, but they realistic that these were advanced cancer patients that were not necessarily really going to get better. And yet these patients somehow kind of took out of this that, oh, things might still be better than they are. And this creates real dilemmas, because people are making decisions at the end of their life, because this most of these patients are going to be at the end of their lives. And the question, I think, is, okay, what do you do? What do you do with this information?
And I got to say that, you know, you and I have spent our lives for the most part on the doctor side of this fence, and we're kind of ingrained not to be totally pessimistic and get people bummed out with stuff. And so we want to be supportive of them. And I think you don't want to diminish hope. You don't like giving bad news. And most of us have been around long enough to see somebody who at first you thought wasn't going to do very well, do very well.
Right. I think that's important, Bob. And I think this is also kind of like a take home. We need to ask our patients, and the oncologists need to ask their patients, what are your values? What are your preferences? What are your wishes? Perhaps they don't want to know that I'm thinking they're going to die in the next few weeks, but perhaps they do, and we should find out what those preferences and values are, and then we can talk about how that fits with our understanding, but it's got to be an open two-way conversation.
And understand that they're going to be naturally optimistic.
Yeah, and we both have seen situations where that probably does help extend some life, but on the other hand, you don't want someone dying a day after their optimism is still there and not having been able to resolve some things they would like to resolve in their life. Speaking right. of resolving something, this next one actually may be the tipping point for my changing the way I think. This next research about artificial sweeteners in a journal called Cell Metabolism. Interesting title.
So we don't often bring stories about fruit flies and mice to report to the people of the greater Triangle area, but this is what stimulated this. On the other hand, it's pretty interesting stuff because what they say is that you have a place in your brain where you are rewarded for eating, and artificial stimulants with sweeteners can make that seem different. And what happens is it actually increases the desire of the animal to eat calories and more food. And so by using artificial sweeteners, you upregulate the ability and you wind up eating more food. So all of us who've been recommending, you know, diet beverages for people for years to avoid calorie consumption have this other thing now that we got to think about, because if it's going to increase the quantity of food it's going to eat, they're not going to do well with their diabetes or their obesity.
Yeah, and this was an artificial sweetener called sucralose, and these fruit flies consume 30% more calories than when they were given kind of naturally sweetened food. I assume that means like with honey or plain sugar. And it also that it promoted this hyperactivity, insomnia, decreased sleep quality. And then finally, just in case you didn't believe the fruit flies, some other researchers reproduced this in mice. So,
right.
Oh, my.
So it needs to be done in people before we're going to truly believe it. But it's a pretty strong suggestion that we're going to be.
Yeah, I'm a firm believer here now that maybe water is the one drink that will probably be okay. Throw a little lemon in there, which would be good. Our last research that matters is about self-rated health. And this is a really interesting concept because in some of the research that I do and our colleagues, Bob, we sometimes will ask someone in a research study, what is your general overall sense of well-being? Would you say it's very good, good, not so good, not very good? And we know, understand in research that that correlates very well with compared to maybe asking 20 other questions about chronic diseases. This says that maybe this sort of question could be useful in a clinical context.
So this comes out of Rice University, and it's a study in psychoneuroendocrinology. And there's a Dr. Fagundes that, or Fagundes, I think, is how you'd say that,
yep.
Reported out. And the rub is what they start off by saying is that people who have high blood pressure and high cholesterol go to the doctor, presumably for well visits, and they feel fine, and something's going on in their body that's going to harm them. And if you ask a cohort of people who've been exposed to contaminated water coming out of Galveston Bay, if they have reactivation of herpes viruses of any kind, they can feel less well, and that somehow should make doctors aware that they don't get the right answer by asking about hypertension or hypercholesterol, because those are asymptomatic diseases in most people, whereas inflammation of herpes can cause lots of pain, rashes, all sorts of things.
Yeah, so we'll just open the conversation on this research today. We won't end that conversation, but it really does suggest that there is something to the fact when a doctor comes in and says, how are you feeling? And the patient says, not well, that one should really stand up and listen, because that may actually signal some underlying inflammation. I find that fascinating. Maybe we can find a guest to really talk about inflammation, important topic. Well, that'll conclude the research that matters, Bob. We're going to take a short break, but when we return, we'll be talking with Dr. Arthur Kaplan, Director of the Division of Medical Ethics at New York University's Langone Medical Center, about the ethics of compassionate use. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Bob Gwyther. We'll be right back. Thank you. UNC Family Medicine's number 2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 919-843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Bob Gwyther. Today on Conversations, Bob, we're talking with Dr. Arthur Kaplan, Director of the Division of Medical Ethics at New York University's Langone Medical Center, about the ethics of compassionate use. Welcome so much to Your Health, Dr. Kaplan.
Hey, thank you for having me.
You know, we're so pleased that you can be with us. And just for our listeners to understand that we are really talking with one of the preeminent bioethicists in the world today. And Dr. Kaplan, you've written dozens of books and hundreds of papers and peer-reviewed articles. But most importantly, you really, what I would say is you do research on topics that matter to people. And so, again, I want to thank you for that, but also ask you, how did you become interested in bioethics as a field of expertise and study?
Well, there's a sort of a deep reason and a slightly more recent reason, meaning only 30 years ago. But the deep reason was when I was a little kid, I was one of the last people in America to have polio. I was in Boston, where I grew up, and wound up in the hospital there for about 9 months. And no doubt it made me think about ethical issues. You know, at that time, your parents couldn't stay over. You couldn't see your dog. The only thing they managed to get to me, I think, was my homework. Being in the first grade, that was not something I was desirous of, but they managed to keep getting it in there. And then we knew they weren't telling us the truth at different times because kids would die, and we knew they were very sick, and they would say they went home or went somewhere else, and that wasn't very likely either. So very early got into thinking about how could you improve the climate for patients, particularly kids, and what about issues like truthfulness? When does it make sense to tell the truth? When might you tell a white lie? That sort of thing. Later, when I was at the Columbia Medical School, I saw lots of issues coming up, and I asked my mentor at the time, who was the chairman of medicine, when do we talk about these ethical issues? And he said, well, you just bring them up with your attending. And Bob and Adam will know bringing ethical issues up with your attending is sort of tantamount to leaving medical school. I mean, they're not going to really be happy to hear your questions or your challenges, at least they weren't at that time. So I decided to get a philosophy degree, and that was it. I kind of got interested in seeing issues literally in the clinic that were, I don't know, they seemed to raise issues for me. So that's how I sort of got to it. And at the time, there wasn't an it to get to because there was no field. So a little bit of a dangerous experiment in trying to pull philosophy and medicine together.
Well, today we're going to talk a little bit about an article you recently wrote for the Journal of American Medical Association about compassionate use. Can you describe for our listeners a little bit about what compassionate use is?
Sure. So when a drug is being developed by a pharmaceutical company or the National Institutes of Health, it has to go through a very set process. And this is true for devices, vaccines as well. First, you have to test them in animals. Then you try them for safety in human beings, a small number of people, just to see if there's any toxic effects in the case of drugs. Then you try to figure out what's the maximum tolerable dose. That's phase 2. The third step is put them in a randomized trial. That's what most of us think about as research. You take a big group of people and try to figure out if whatever you're studying helps. And if that data comes through, you get approval from the FDA, and the last step is just to watch what happens when drugs are out in the world. Some listeners may remember problems with drugs like Vioxx. Those were approved drugs but got pulled back when safety issues arose once they were being prescribed. Well, compassionate use is trying to get access to a drug that hasn't been approved. It hasn't been through phase 1, 2, or 3. There may be some data coming in. The company may know that something looks promising for cancer or Alzheimer's or depression, but it hasn't yet received approval, and yet an individual, a patient, sometimes a child, may want to get that drug because it's one of their last hopes. They've tried everything else that's out there.
Let me ask a question. We call it compassionate use, but it's interesting. It suggests that the use itself would be good. And I'm also thinking back to when I had a very close relative dying of HIV disease at a time in which we only had one drug. We didn't have a triple drug, and we didn't know that the other drugs were going to be effective. And I remember getting access to thalidomide because it was a drug that was being potentially used for HIV. We knew the toxicities in non-HIV, and we thought it might work. And I remember actually I went through all the steps, and I actually got a supply of this particular drug as compassionate use. Well, it turned out it was not a drug that was particularly useful for the disease. Was it compassionate?
Good question. So most people think, well, if something is my last shot, I'd like to get it, and I hope that people would be compassionate and give it to me. But oftentimes, things that are being studied don't work. They fail. They could cost you money. They could cost you effort in terms of getting to trials and taking them. Sometimes they can make you sicker, and sometimes, sadly, they could cause you to die faster. For people with a long memory, that's what happened with the first round of artificial hearts. Barney Clark, a dentist out in Utah, got one, made him very, very sick. He was going to die without it, but he died faster and more miserably with it. So compassion, yeah, the intent is to try and help, but when you use these unapproved experimental things, they can do harm, no doubt about it.
Here's another question. A lot of people in the country think the FDA, that's the Food and Drug Administration, is whose primary responsibility is approving these medicines, is the primary blocker of compassionate use. But your article, we were sort of surprised to see that 99% of compassionate use requests are granted by the FDA.
Yeah, the FDA isn't the culprit, although many people try to make it out to be in terms of blocking requests for a drug or a experimental device or vaccine. So the reason is very simple. If you want something, you have to talk to your doctor, and your doctor has to make an application, if you will, to the company that has the drug. The company makes the decision about whether or not they're willing to give it to you. It's not the FDA. It's not anybody else. It's up to the company because they own it. It's their property, if you will. They're trying to get it approved, and whether they want to sort of step out of that process and say, yep, we're going to make something available, completely their decision. Government can't make it give it to you. FDA can't force them to give it to you. They have to decide. If they do say we're going to let you try something, then the FDA steps in and has to approve it, but as the data shows, 99.8% of the time, the FDA says okay if a company's willing to let somebody try something. And the people we're talking about here, just to be clear, who are making these requests, they're almost always terminally ill or becoming very, very disabled, Alzheimer's, MS, muscular dystrophy, blindness. So that's who's making the request. These are people who are really sliding towards some pretty lousy endpoints.
So what's the difference between people getting access to experimental drugs and those who are getting access or seeking compassionate use? Is there an important difference?
Well, when you seek access as one person, that's what we call compassionate use. Sometimes groups of people, say a category like everybody who has MS, wants to try something that isn't yet approved. That's what we refer to as expanded access. The FDA will let a company that's willing to do it create a little program and start to distribute, as happened with you and HIV, to a bunch of people. So they have certain requirements about keeping tabs on adverse events, but it's usually pretty minimal, and there are a number of expanded access programs oriented to companies and diseases. But when a single person says, boy, I don't have long to live from my multiple myeloma or whatever's killing me, I'd like to take a shot at something, that's compassionate use.
Well, we're going to take a short break. This is a really important and fascinating conversation. We come back, Dr. Kaplan, I really want us to talk about the program that you have established there in association with Janssen about one of these new treatments and compassionate use, and how this is a model or not for other ways of looking at this disease and, this process. So we're going to take a short break, but when we return, we're going to continue having our conversation with Dr. Arthur Kaplan, Director of the Division of Medical Ethics at NYU's Langone Medical Center, about the ethics of compassionate use. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Bob Gwyther. We'll be right back.
Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Bob Gwyther. We've been talking with Dr. Arthur Kaplan, Director of the Division of Medical Ethics at New York University's Langone Medical Center, about the ethics of compassionate use.
You write in your article that Janssen Pharmaceuticals contacted your division last year about reviewing compassionate use requests in a fair way. And in response to that, you created something called the Compassionate Use Advisory Committee, or COMP-AC. Could you tell our listeners and a little bit about COMP-AC, who serves on it, and how well it worked out?
Sure. So this is, I think listeners will find this pretty interesting. The old way of trying to get an experimental drug, if you were dying or your child had a terrible brain tumor, some family member was being afflicted with Alzheimer's, you basically tried to figure out who knew somebody at the company, and then you'd work to see if your doctor or someone you knew could call the CEO of the company, literally at a Glaxo or a Novartis or small companies, and say, could you please help me or my relative? Other people start social media campaigns. You've seen them on the news. You see them on the internet. Please help my child. Please help this person. Please help me. But neither of those methods are fair. So some people don't know how to do social media. Some people don't want to do social media. And in some instances, obviously, some people aren't connected, so they can't get to the company CEO. And as I said, the company controls the decision about whether they're going to give something or not. So that all seems so unfair that we formed this relationship with Janssen, which is the drug division of Johnson & Johnson, and said, let's try a drug. And we picked one that was in research, not approved yet, but looking pretty good for multiple myeloma, called daratumumab, now called Darolux. Multiple myeloma is a horrible disease, weakens your bones, has all kinds of terrible side effects, and will kill you. So terrible, terrible disease. A lot of people might want to get that drug who may not live long enough to be in a clinical trial. So we set up a committee, 10 people from all over the world, because we got requests from all over the world, some ethicists, some doctors, and some patient advocates. And each one of them was told in any week, three of you were going to vote on the requests that come into the company, because many were coming in, to give out this drug. And the drug was sadly in short supply, so we knew we couldn't give it to everyone. And we did two things, again, I think listeners will be interested in. One, we anonymized all the requests. So doctors would ask on behalf of their patients, but we didn't know their names. We didn't know their country. We didn't even know, to tell you the truth, whether they're men or women. We blinded all that, tried to make it fair. And the other thing we did was we tried to make sure that we gave the drug to people who were more likely to benefit. For example, if you're really, really sick, it takes a while for this drug to get in your body, into your bloodstream. So if you have only a few weeks to live, sadly, we had to rule you out because the drug wouldn't be taken up by that person fast enough to do any good. So we had some pretty tough decisions, pretty hard, but I think we made a fairer way to go and maybe a model for other situations, even things like giving out drugs in the Ebola or Zika epidemic.
Were there some things that were unexpected? You know, you're using a really nice model to ethically come to some good decisions. And I'm wondering if in so doing, there were some things that were unexpected that created some maybe additional questions. And one I think about is, you know, you have someone who you maybe are maybe saying they're going to go into a clinical trial, but you're automatically potentially 50% of the time they're not going to get the drug. And how does that look, act, and feel, kind of, even so, though, and you're distancing yourself somewhat from the person purposefully. I don't know if that creates a problem or not.
Yeah. Well, remember, it was worse because we had some other drugs out there that were approved for this disease. The one they were studying was definitely going to randomize you to placebo, but we only decided to take people who had failed on the approved drug. Mm-hmm. So there was something was working for some folks, but once you failed it, then we took you as a potential candidate. The kind of people that were asking us were so sick, they really weren't great for clinical trials. They tended to be later, further down the road of the disease, although there may have been one or two who tried to get in through compassionate use rather than a clinical trial. We were trying to push them back to the trial because, again, we didn't know if the drug was going to work or if it was going to hurt them or help them. But I'll tell you, we were surprised just about every week. Issues came up like, well, in some countries in around the world, the drug wasn't available because the local government wouldn't let it in because customs wouldn't let it in. Get a request, and then we'd sit there and say, we can't ship there because it's going to be hung up at customs for 2 months until it clears, and the drug's going to go bad. We didn't even think about issues like shipping and customs. We also encountered things like, does it make a difference how old you are? Multiple myeloma is a disease that affects older people, probably 50 and up. So I think we had a lot of internal discussion about whether age should matter, 50 versus 90. We weren't willing to make any distinction between, say, a 50-year-old and a 55-year-old. But at some point, people began to say, you know, it's more likely that you're going to get more life years saved if you give it to the 50-year-old than if you give it to the 90-year-old. So we did. We edged in that direction, but weakly. It was only a tiebreaker for us.
Wow.
So we live in a pretty physician-dense area here, and a lot of people get seen by specialists, oncologists often, but others that might have real ethical questions. And
right.
So I'm wondering, are there best ways to guide patients to drugs under trial that might help them get in, would you say?
So this is a great question, too, and it's something we also learned about. I assumed, say for a disease like multiple myeloma, but it could apply to any terrible disease, that doctors would know about what trials are going on in their area. Well, not all do. So you have to push your doctor and say, could you make sure to do a literature review, see what's going on out there that might be in trials that I could ask the company for compassionate use. There is a website run by the NIH called clinicaltrials.gov. I don't consider it the best website, but it is a resource, and patients and doctors can go there. We also pushed the FDA to streamline its paperwork a bit, so it'd be easier for doctors to ask. It wasn't a huge roadblock, but they simplified it a bit, so it becomes somewhat easier. One thing we need in this country is to think about how to get all the information that's out there about who's doing clinical trials all around the world in one place that is doctor and patient friendly. We don't have that yet. The NIH website is a little bit of a help, but we've really got to work on that more. That would really open the door for people who are trying to do these searches and desperate to find something.
Are there things that states could be doing, any regulatory other actions that need to occur to facilitate this groundbreaking work? Because this is one institution with one drug. I imagine
right.
that there are multiple drugs even within an institution.
There are. And in fact, one of the ironies of working on the Janssen drug for multiple myeloma is it just got approved. The FDA just said, okay, so you can now get it prescribed to you. You don't have to go through committees or clinical trials or anything else. But we're going to move on to some other agents, probably take a look at one for children, might take a look at one involving a vaccine that might be useful as an antidote to certain viral infections for babies. So we'll move forward and try this model out. But to answer your question, states have been trying to pass laws to make it easier to get access under compassionate use for desperately ill people. However, I don't like the laws because what they do is they pinpoint the FDA. They keep saying the FDA is the issue. FDA isn't the issue. What you might want to do if you're a state is create a little fund to say to people, here's how you could buy or pay for the drug from a little company. They don't have always the money. And then here's money to help you travel to get to the drug. So those are big obstacles, these so-called right-to-try laws that a lot of states have passed. Well, I think they're well-intended, but I don't think they do the job.
If you could leave our listeners with one final message, what would it be?
Compassionate use is no guarantee. I understand why people want to try things. They have to understand it's a mixed bag. Sometimes it doesn't work. It can cost you money. and it can make you sicker. But if you do decide that you would like to try it, or you have a loved one or a friend or someone who wants to do it, then push your physician to make sure that you know all the trials that are going on out there in the literature that have been reported. And then you have to make your best case to the company. And the way to do that is to have your doctor really advocate for you to the company, not the FDA. You got to put together that good letter saying why you're a good candidate, why it makes sense to try. And I think that's your best bet right now until we build this sort of national and international website.
Well, we've been talking with Dr. Arthur Kaplan, Director of the Division of Medical Ethics at New York University's Langone Medical Center, about the ethics of compassionate use. And Dr. Kaplan, on behalf of your health listeners, we really need to thank you for advocating for this important and impressive compassionate use protocols and committees, and moving this whole dialogue forward in ways that gets beyond perhaps arguing on right and wrong and looks at what are the ethics and how do we help people. Thank you so much.
Hey, thanks very much.
We're going to take a short break, but coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Bob White. We'll be right back.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Your Health. For the House Call segment of our show today, Bob and I are going to spend a few minutes talking about your health questions and concerns. And if you have a question you'd like us to address on an upcoming show, we're going to send your comments to yourhealth@unc.edu. And we'd like to ask our great executive producer, Daniel Lane, to read us our very first House Call question. Hey, Daniel.
A patient recently sent the following note to their doctor that read in part, "Please take care of yourself as you take care of others." What are your thoughts about such a message from a patient to a doctor?
Well, you know, there could be a lot of reasons for that. But I think on average, probably what somebody is concerned about their doctor and trying to express that to them. I mean, if they see that they're obese and trying to talk somebody into a diet, that could be a challenge. Or if they smell like they just had a cigarette in the office visit, that may be a point being made by the patient that the physician needs to clean up their act. But I think it should be explored. And I don't think there's any physician worth their salt who isn't able to listen to messages, however they are. If it's just simply, "I like you, doctor, take good care of yourself," or
"Amen,
you
Bob.
Need to lose weight," you know, whatever.
Amen. And I think it potentially could be something that a doctor really should take notice. If you're coming in 30 minutes late to every visit and you seem stressed and, you know, a little short, and the patient's just trying to be nice and saying, you know, "You need to take care of yourself," there, you know, maybe. So I would take notice that it could be something a little bit more. I could learn from it. But also, I think you're absolutely right, Bob. This is just, it's something nice. This is, you know, I would tell the patient, "Thank you so much for your kind note." What's our very next house call, Daniel?
Why do insurance companies not routinely pay for a person to get a shingles shot under the age of 60 when the recommendations are to give the shingles shot to anyone over the age of 50?
Oh, my goodness gracious. I probably spend, I don't want to tell you how much time every week on something like this, Bob. We can talk about the research that shows why that may be the case and why it maybe shouldn't be the case, but then we'll end up being, well, that is the case.
Yeah. In fact, there is research to show that if you study people who get it between 50 and 60 and do it in a case-controlled study where somebody gets a placebo and the other one doesn't, the people who get the placebo have a rate of 6.6 per thousand people of getting shingles after the bogus shot. And then the zoster vaccine got it down as low as 2 per 1,000.
Yeah, so it's much very better. It's very effective, and it's as effective as those over age 60. But the problem is that some of and the United States Food and Drug Administration has approved the shingles vaccination for those that are older than 50, but the immunization committee has recommended it for those over age 60, and the insurance companies are going to kind of follow what that immunization committee, not necessarily what the medical evidence may show. So you may think, and the doctor may think, "Oh, it's good for you over age 50," but the insurance company too often is not going to cover it yet.
And they're going to pay attention to the one that they can justify but costs them the least. So I think there's that too, because money sticks its nose into this one.
I think if you do have some extra risk factors, you probably should talk with your doctor about whether or not that shingles vaccination earlier would be better for you, and let your doctor maybe work with the insurance company to get something approved. That could be a win-win. think so. Daniel, what's our very next house call?
Recently, I had dark green stools for 2 days that have gotten better. I'm concerned, however, that I might have some parasites or even worse, early pancreatic cancer. I have no pain and I can't think of anything changing. I do take some vitamin supplements and I appreciate your thoughts on this.
Well, you know, stool comes in all kinds of colors, and green, though maybe not the most common one, is certainly happens. And you can get green stool from a variety of things, including the chlorophyll in green leafy vegetables, including certain dyes you might use because somebody dyed a snow cone or a birthday cake or whatever. And it's not worrisome if there's nothing else to go along with it. Now, you may have heard that vomiting green stuff is bad because that's frequently bile and an indication of disease. But having it in stool is not a worrisome thing particularly.
Yeah, I've even heard, Bob, that eating certain purple foods can result in green stools. The best thing I heard is that you have no pain. It kind of went away. You got better. I do also think sometimes that supplements can do some strange things. So I do know some supplements, particularly those that are higher in iron, can give a greenish tinge. So I would encourage you to talk with your doctor, but I'm so glad that, you know, no one likes green stools.
Yeah, and so you can talk to your doctor the next time you see him. I don't think you need to run in to make a special appointment for that, given that it's all gone away and you're feeling fine.
Sounds good to me. Daniel, what's our very last house call?
I've had fatigue for years. I know I'm a little depressed, and I've had some relationship problems too. However, I'm so tired that I can't do exercise, and I want to sleep all the time. How do you know if there's something else going on? My doctor checked my thyroid, blood counts, and tick exposure, but told me all these were negative. Should I see an alternative provider?
Well, Bob, we might have to do a whole show on this particular one, and we don't want to alienate anyone here. And the answer is yes, no, and maybe.
There are a variety of illnesses that can cause fatigue. Most notable is probably the chronic fatigue syndrome, which can be very profound and very long. There's loads of viruses that can cause this. Various cancers can cause it. Inflammatory diseases can cause it. There's a variety of things that can do this. And your doctor did a perfunctory screen of a couple of things, and it's pretty high-yield stuff if it's positive. But you didn't get an answer. My question is, did somebody do a physical exam and you feel your lymph nodes, feel your organs, and see if there's anything awry in your physical exam, and then maybe do some more pointed things.
Yeah, I agree, Bob. And I think sometimes we are too quick to rush to a judgment. You know, you say you've had a little depression and some relationship problems. Well, we do know depression and stress, those things combined can certainly cause fatigue. And that may well be the most likely issue. But I would be hesitate to say that without having someone spend 60 minutes, 90 minutes, even longer with you, so a prolonged visit. Now, your primary care doctor may not devote that amount of time, may not have that amount of time. You may have to involve another therapist or other alternative provider. If they can spend a lot of time and they don't rush to do a lot of things that are really expensive, I would be, you know, supportive of anyone who can really sit and listen and try to figure it out. But anyone who suggests something that's going to cost you hundreds of thousands of dollars or tens of thousands or even hundreds of dollars, I would sometimes be a little worried about.
And always be aware of drug side effects. So if you're taking any medicines, either prescription or over the counter, beware that that can cause fatigue a lot of times too.
Well, that'll conclude our house calls today. And we want to thank you all for joining us today for your health. We hope we've addressed issues, concerns that are important to you and your health. You can send your questions, stories, email us at yourhealth@unc.edu. You can visit us online at yourhealthradio.org. Follow us on Twitter, Facebook, iTunes, or just search our health app, one word, Your Health, for a free download. We'd like to thank the UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare, for their sponsorship. I want to thank my great guest co-host today, Dr. Bob Gwyther, and our guest today, Dr. Arthur Kaplan. We hope you'll join us next time on Your Health.
On behalf of Your Health, I'm Dr. Bob Gwyther. We look forward to talking to you again next week.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your Health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
You've been listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine.